Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Welcome, you're tuned into the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. You know, one of my favorite parts about doing the show, Tim, after all these years, going on to 13 years this coming year, is all of the great guests that we've been able to speak to.
Oh, yes.
On different aspects and theories and beliefs. But whenever people ask me, okay, you've talked to so many amazing people. If you could sit down with somebody right now and have a dinner conversation with somebody alive or dead, who would it be? And I've got to be honest with you. Our guest tonight is that guy.
Really?
Oh, yeah. You know what? I love science. I love theories. I love the ideas behind what's actually going on in the universe around us, right? And listen, like a lot of people out there, you get turned off by science because sometimes it's dry, it's boring, it's non-relatable. But our guest has always had this great enthusiasm and energy. He brings something to the table that makes science fun. It's something that I can listen to, my kids have listened to with me, as we, whether it's YouTube videos and interviews he's done, or his own radio show, or his many visits with George Norrie on Coast to Coast AM. I can never get him when I'm guest hosting, Tim, because George gets to suck up all the good guests. But it's about time. 12 years on the air, this is a guest I've been excited to have join us. He has a brand new book called The Future of Humanity, Terraforming Mars, Interstellar Travel, Immortality, and Our Destiny Beyond Earth. Welcome for the first time to Beyond the Darkness, Dr. Michio Kaku. Thank you so much for joining us today, sir.
Well, glad to be on the show.
It's, like I said, I want to thank you personally. Just, you've made science fun, and you've made it entertaining, and something that even my kids look forward to. Our home, when I host Coast to Coast AM, KNSI up in St. Cloud, carries your show, and my kids have tuned in with me and listened to that prior to Coast, and they're as fascinated. And I love that somebody can bring science to the mainstream and make it entertaining and fun and educational, and you walk away learning something. So personally, I just want to thank you for the work you're doing and making it accessible to so many people.
Well, after hearing such a great introduction, I can't wait to hear the speaker myself.
Let's get going on this. With the new book, and I want to kind of backtrack, if I could, for just a few minutes. Over the years of doing our show with an interest in the paranormal, many guests will come on and say, quantum physics is proving this, physics is proving that. And I've tried to find where there's actual notes about this, or there's something. Can you give us some background on this? Is there anything that quantum physics or physics in general has really told us about the paranormal? Ghosts, cryptids, alternate universes, parallel universes bleeding over? Are there real points to this where we can find it's not just theoretical, but there is proof that these things exist?
Well, in quantum physics at the microscopic level allows all sorts of bizarre, weird things to happen. Things can disappear, reappear someplace else. Things can be two places at the same time. Things that are dead in one universe could be alive in another universe. Things that we consider impossible happen all the time in the subatomic realm. And of what use is that? That's why we have lasers. That's why we have transistors. That's why you're hearing my voice. All of it a consequence of quantum physics. If you were to shut off quantum physics, we'd be hurled back 100 years back into the past, before the transistor, before television, radio, radar, all of that is a byproduct of quantum physics. Now, the question is, can that happen on our scale, not the subatomic scale? that is reappearing, disappearing, walking through walls, coming back from the dead? Can that happen at the microscopic level? Well, we can discuss that in this show.
Excellent. Looking forward to it. The book that is out and available, as a matter of fact, it hits today, the 20th, covers a myriad of different topics, including science today, warp drive, wormholes, hyperspace, parallel universes, and the multiverse. Let's dive right in on this. When you start looking at the future of humanity, how much of this is theory of what's going to come, or your knowledge that this is, we're right here, we're on the cutting edge and the cusp of this is the next step and actually going to happen, not just science fiction, Isaac Asimov hoping that this will occur in the future at some point?
Well, just 3 weeks ago, we had Elon Musk with the Falcon Heavy rocket that was watched by millions of people because they realized that this was a moon rocket. This is no ordinary rocket. It's a moon rocket that was financed by somebody's checkbook, Elon Musk, and it's going to take us to the moon. And just back in December, the President of the United States signed it as an executive order. We're going back to the moon, on to Mars, and beyond. So all the dreams of science fiction fans are coming to be. Prices are dropping. Everybody's jumping in the game. China, India. In fact, the Indian government sent a probe to Mars costing only $70 million. That's cheaper than the movie The Martian. You realize the Hollywood movies now cost more than actual missions to Mars. And that's how this is a game changer. This has changed everything. The fact that we're going to the moon next year in 2019, NASA is going to send the SLS booster rocket onto the moon, an unmanned mission. In 2023, we're talking about humans going back to the moon. In 2030, we're talking about perhaps going to Mars. And so this is a dream of science fiction writers, and it's now coming to fruition. We're entering a new golden age of space travel.
When we start to look at these ideas and the fact that these things are coming and we're making these moves, why do you think there was such a stagnant period for such a long point from our initial exploration of space to just kind of allowing ourselves to, you know, hover around the Earth and not push beyond that in manned missions?
Well, in 1966, the NASA budget was 5% of the entire federal budget. Now, that's intolerable. That's too much. And it was unsustainable. And as soon as the Cold War wound down, boom, funding went down to 0.5%, not 5% of the federal budget. Now prices have dropped. That rocket that you saw on the Internet blasting off from SpaceX, Cape Canaveral, that rocket will reduce the cost of space travel by a factor of 10. Instead of $10,000 a pound to put anything into orbit, that's your weight in gold, by the way. Your weight in solid gold is what it costs to put you in orbit. Prices are going to drop to $1,000 a pound. That's a factor of 10. And so we're going to enter a new golden age of space exploration. Space tourism is going to open up. Asteroid mining is going to open up. The first settlements are going to be created on the planet Mars. All the stuff you read about in Isaac Asimov's science fiction novels are going to come to be because of the dropping prices of space travel.
All right, so most of it's just been, as you're saying, a financial burden that's now being lifted from what has kept us from making these next steps.
That's right. And, of course, Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, the richest men on Earth, there's a reason why they're opening their checkbooks for this new golden age of space exploration. For Elon Musk, we want to be a multi-planet species. It's too dangerous to put all of humanity on just one planet because, after all, the dinosaurs had no space program. Dinosaurs didn't have a space program, and that's why they're not here today to talk about it, okay? We do have a space program, and that's why we are here to talk about it, and that's why we're thinking about becoming a multi-planet species. Now, with Jeff Bezos of Amazon.com, he's created his own spaceport in Texas. He's creating his own rocket for space tourism and a rocket to go to the moon. There could be a traffic jam. A traffic around the moon because NASA has the SLS booster, Elon Musk has the Falcon Heavy, and Jeff Bezos has the Blue Origin series of rockets. And so who would have thought? Who would have thought back in the 1960s that we would have China, India, Silicon Valley billionaires bankrolling all these projects to the moon and on to Mars?
Do you think we stand to possibly be bogged down again because of the technology boom and because of all of these different cultures and countries jumping into the space race and independent parties doing it, that there has to be some kind of regulatory system put into place to watch how this progression moves forward?
Well, ultimately, we may need a new treaty, because the Chinese have said they want to put their flag on the moon. The Indians don't want to be outdone by the Chinese. And so, and eventually, when we go to Mars, there could be competing interests. Google wants to mine the asteroid belt, and so there could be competing commercial interests there. We may have to revise the Outer Space Treaty of 1967. The Outer Space Treaty of 1967 simply says you cannot put weapons and nuclear weapons into outer space, but they never visualize in their wildest dreams. They never realize that a private individual can go to the moon using private funds. And so there's no regulation about mining the moon, about staking claims on the moon by private individuals. And so we may have to rewrite the rules, because there are so many players now, prices have dropped so much, that we may have to rewrite the Outer Space Treaty of 1967.
Wasn't it? I thought in that treaty it said that it was kind of no one would ever own that, any of that aspect, that it would always be just kind of a general, whoever ended up making it out there, they were, you know, able to visit and make it part of their world, but they could never claim ownership, like we could never claim ownership of the moon.
Yeah, but prospecting rights, who owns land if somebody plants a flag in the moon, stuff like that. What happens when the Russians get involved with their space program and the European Space Agency? All these questions are going to be hashed out again, because we're entering a new phase in the space race. The Cold War is no longer the wind driving the sails of these ventures. We're now having, you know, private enterprises, developing nations coming into the game. And so we're going to have to essentially rewrite the rules, because there's going to be a traffic jam around the moon and a traffic jam around Mars.
Do you think, and I'm not trying to pull back on this, you know, forward progressive thinking and work, you know, as we're looking to terraform and move to other planets and move to other realms, should a large portion of that money that's being allocated to do so, should that just be positioned back here on Earth to clean up our own mess and the stuff that we're doing here, so that maybe we're not in need of rushing to find other planets to habitate in case, you know, we've ruined the atmosphere or ruined the ground that we live on currently?
Well, I don't think there should be a crash program that then sucks dry the national budget. I think we have to solve Earth problems on the Earth. In other words, some people want to go to Mars because we're messing up the Earth with global warming,
right,
and nuclear weapons and stuff like that. I don't believe so. I think we should clean up the Earth on our own, independent of what we do with the moon and Mars. And personally, I think we should have a settlement there. We're not going to move the entire population of the Earth to Mars. That's not going to happen. That costs too much money. But a settlement Mars on Mars as an insurance policy, as a backup plan, that's what Carl Sagan and many other people have written about, that we need a backup plan in case global warming gets out of control, in case another asteroid hits the Earth. A settlement on Mars, not necessarily gigantic populations and huge continents of people moving to Mars. Elon Musk, for example, talks about a settlement, maybe 1,000 people, settlers per rocket, and then a settlement of maybe 1 million people. And so we're talking about a new branch of humanity, but not necessarily having half the population of the Earth go to Mars. We have to solve Earth-like problems on the Earth.
I agree. That's what my thoughts were. Is I'm afraid that in some cases we're going to be so progressive in our thoughts of let's find some other place to go that we're going to forget what needs to be fixed here, because we're already on to that next venture.
Right. But remember that the average person is going to benefit from all this, as well as, of course, the possibility of dangers. The first golden age of space exploration gave us miniaturized transistors. The iPhone, the Internet, a lot of that was because we had to miniaturize electronics to fit into the capsule of the Apollo spacecraft. And so we benefited with the consumer products. Multi-trillion-dollar companies like Apple have come out of the space program in some sense. Now, going to Mars, we're going to have a second gigantic influx of commercial products, because we're going to go to quantum computers. We're going to go to artificial intelligence. We're going to go to molecular transistors. And so the public's going to benefit that way. Also, children are going to benefit. because we had that Sputnik moment back in 1957. But since then, there's no more Sputnik moment. Kids are only recently now dreaming about becoming astronauts again. They want to become scientists. But for 50 years, we pretty much forgot about that. And so I think all that's going to come back. There's going to be a new interest in exploring the universe, a new interest in science, and I think that's good for the country.
I agree. The idea that we're going to be making these moves, these jumps and looks, and we've got probes and Voyager out there past further than we ever expected it was going to go, doing these things and bringing us back information. You know, we're at a precipice in our time where we're seeing things that even science fiction couldn't believe or imagine at that point. But the idea of travel and warp drive and utilizing wormholes for this kind of travel, do you think this is still something that's going to fall into that realm of science fiction? Or do you believe that we're also 20, 40, 50 years away from breaking those codes?
Well, first of all, the first starship to reach Alpha Centauri, the closest star system, will be launched in a few decades because Stephen Hawking, my colleague, and others have backed the Breakthrough Starshot program. We want to take chips, computer chips, not the Enterprise, but computer chips, stick them onto a parachute, and inflate the parachute with laser beams, 800 billion watts of power's worth, and shoot them at 20% the speed of light to the nearby stars. It would take 20 years for a journey to the nearby stars. And then NASA has something called the 100-year Starship Program, stating that within 100 years, we should seriously think about what options are available. There's fusion power, there's antimatter rockets, there's ramjet rockets. They'll take us to about half the speed of light. And so they're not going to break the light barrier, but I think within the next century, NASA is already looking at the 100-year Starship. And then beyond that, we start to go to my field, my specialization, which is string theory. String theory allows for the possibility of wormholes because it was Einstein himself in 1935 who first introduced the idea that a wormhole could be a gateway to another universe. Now that we found all these black holes in outer space, we realize that at the heart of a black hole, there could be a ring. A ring, not a dot, but a ring of neutrons circulating very rapidly. And if you fall through the ring, you wind up into another universe. And in fact, if you saw the movie Interstellar, one of my colleagues, Kip Thorne, who just won the Nobel Prize last year, Kip Thorne was one of the scientific advisors to a film where you went through the wormhole. You went through the wormhole with Matthew McConaughey in that movie to another sector of the galaxy. And so even though we can't do it yet, we physicists are working out the mathematics, and with string theory, we may be able to one day in the future definitively say whether or not time travel and wormhole travel is a real possibility.
In your opinion, looking past the theory, do you believe that that does exist?
Oh, I think that, I cannot say because string theory is not solved completely to answer the question. But I think it's a real possibility that string theory allows for topology change. That is, to create a rip in the fabric of space and time, just like going to the looking glass of Alice. The looking glass of Alice is the black hole. The rim of the looking glass is a ring, and that ring could be concentrated neutrons spinning inside a black hole. And when you stick your hand through the ring, like Alice did, your hand winds up on the other side of the universe. The mathematics were worked out in 1963 by mathematician Roy Kerr, and Roy Kerr found that if you fall through the wormhole once, you can fall through it a second time, and a third time, and a fourth time, winding up on parallel universes each time you do that. And so we have to take the idea of a multiverse seriously now. You can go to any physics conference today on the Earth, say the word multiverse, and people will listen. Because there are conferences now about the multiverse. In other words, Einstein gives us a picture that the universe is a bubble. We live on the surface of the bubble, and the bubble is expanding. That's called the Big Bang Theory, now on CBS television. But we think that there are other bubbles out there, a multiverse of bubbles, giving us a bubble bath of universes. And when these universes bump into each other, well, that's the Big Bang. people often ask the question, what happened before the Big Bang? Well, what happened before the Big Bang was the multiverse. The multiverse, this bubble bath of universes, universes can fission in half, create baby universes, or collide with other universes, creating a bigger universe. And that's probably what happened before creation.
Does that leave room then for God, for the belief in spirituality that there is one mind, one collective that has created this? Or do you think that that does remove the idea of theology and religion from the culture of our world?
Well, that's a big one. I have several chapters of my books, Parallel Worlds, and my new book, The Future of Humanity, on that question. First of all, let's look at it the way Galileo looked at it. Galileo said that there's a difference between science and religion. Science is there to help us understand how the heavens go. Religion is there to understand how to go to heaven. So, in other words, science is about natural law, about how the heavens go, while religion is about ethics, about how to be a good person, how to go to heaven. So as long as we keep that distinction clear, there's no problem at all. The problem occurs when scientists pontificate about everything, including theology, morality, God, so on and so forth. That gets us into big trouble. The other trouble is when people from the religious faith start to pontificate about natural law. As long as we keep the distinction between these two separate, I think we're in good shape. Now, Einstein was asked this very same question. And Einstein said that, well, there really are two kinds of God. You have to be clear. There really are two kinds of God. First is the God that he believed in, the God of harmony, the God of beauty, simplicity, that the universe could not have been an accident because it's so gorgeous. The second kind of God that he didn't believe in was the personal God, the God that smites the Philistines, the God that seeks vengeance, the God that answers your prayer at Christmas time. He didn't believe that the God of the universe spent all his time contemplating about how to give bicycles for kids for Christmas just because they pray for it.
Right.
But he did believe that the universe was like a gigantic library, and he's like a little boy entering the library. And he could take out the first book, chapter 1, page 1, and read the first page, and that's it. But before him was this gigantic library of knowledge about the universe. And so I think that's a humble, but I think more correct way to look at religion and science.
And that's a great way. That's something new to me as well. So let's then talk about the science of who we are. And again, people love to bandy about the thought that we are energy, energy cannot be destroyed, therefore we continue on after we leave our physical form. Energy can't be destroyed, but it can be disbanded, or it can be broken down. Do you believe that we exist outside of this physical form?
Well,
as
in
a being?
My book, I have a chapter on the question of immortality.
Mm-hmm.
That is, why do we have to die at all? And there are two kinds of immortality. There's digital immortality and genetic and biological immortality. So let's separate the two. Years ago, we had something called dualism during the Middle Ages. There was the soul and the body. When you died, the body rotted, but the soul went to heaven. That's called dualism. Then came neuroscience. And neuroscience says, well, we poked in the brain. We can't find a soul there. Maybe it's just neurons. Now we're coming back to dualism, because now we have something called the Connectome Project. Just like the Manhattan Project gave us the atomic bomb, the Genome Project gave us the genome, the Connectome Project is giving us the brain. We are going to map the entire brain, every single neuron. And by the time we do it, maybe the end of the century, we'll have a disk with all your neurons on it, which in principle contains all your memories, all your sensations, your personality, all your quirks, everything in a disk. And when you die, well, your biological self will die, but that disk will live on forever. And in that sense, you'll be digitally immortal. And that means, for example, that your descendants will be able to go to a library, conjure up you. a holographic image of you that has all the information about you, all your videotapes, all your Instagrams, all your emails, all your credit card transactions, and will create a very good representation of you. And so one day you'll talk to your descendants. You'll talk to your great-great-great-great-great-great-grandchild, and they'll talk to you. Now, I wouldn't mind going to the library and talking to Einstein. I'd love the opportunity to talk to Einstein. And that's going to be a possibility because we're going to digitize people so that in that sense, they will live forever. And in fact, I believe personally that once we digitize consciousness, we'll put it on a laser beam and shoot it into outer space. We'll be on the moon in 1 second. We'll be on Mars in 20 minutes. We'll be in the nearby stars in 4 minutes. This is called laser porting, when you laser port your consciousness throughout the universe. And I think that this already exists. I don't think this is science fiction. I think this already exists. I think aliens that are out there, and I do think they're out there someplace, they probably already laser port themselves across the galaxy. They don't bother with flying saucers. That's old hat. That's like, oh, last century flying saucers. They simply digitize their consciousness and send it on superhighways. And next to the Earth, there could be a superhighway where billions of souls are being laser-ported from star to star, and we are too primitive and too stupid to know it. Right under our noses, there could be billions of souls going across the stars, and we're simply too stupid to know it.
So you think that perhaps these visitations are nothing more than a holographic image or a visual presentation of these beings from wherever they are? And almost like the movie Avatar, it sounds like, right? That they're able to come through this imagery and they're allowed to witness or see things, but they may not physically be here. They're more of a telepathic vision of what they are. Or representation.
Well, that's a possibility. I think there are several possibilities. One is, of course, that they physically go between star systems, but mm-hmm. that is very clumsy, very dangerous, very slow. A much better way is to laser port yourself at the speed of light and reach the stars within a matter of decades. And once you reach the moon, for example, it only takes 1 second to reach the moon on a light beam, you would download your consciousness into a computer. And then the computer would download your consciousness into an avatar. The avatar could either be holographic or robotic. I mean, why not go to Mars with the body of a superhero? Why not leap tall buildings in a single bound? You'd be able to download your consciousness into a robot with superpowers, so you don't have to worry about weightlessness, about gases that are noxious and toxic, and so on and so forth. You could become a Superman and fly on the surface of Mars because your avatar has that capability. So if I was an alien and I had technology thousands of years more advanced than Earthlings, I wouldn't bother with flying saucers. I simply teleport or laser port myself across the universe and resurrect myself on different star systems, different moons, and have a great vacation. I could travel across many star systems, perhaps in just a few years' time, a great way to vacation, and I would basically rent the body. I would land on a moon, rent the body for a day, walk around the moon with superpowers, then zap myself to the next planet, rent my next body, and walk around on a different planet that could be aquatic, that could be gaseous, whatever. And that would be a great vacation. And it seems to me that alien civilizations could be thousands of years more advanced than us, but we always assume they're only 100 years ahead of us. We always assume they're just like a carbon copy of us, except they have a flying saucer. No, I think they could be thousands of years ahead of us, in which case for them, pure consciousness could be shot throughout the galaxy.
That would then, if they've got these avatars or these figures here, that means that the foresight had to be like us. We'd have to launch these things off to these different star systems or planets so that at some point we could download or laser port ourselves into those avatars.
Yeah, in fact, if you take a look at a movie from Hollywood, the most scientifically accurate movie is the movie 2001, because if you are such an advanced civilization, you'll send these probes to moons because moons are stable and nova erosion takes place, and it creates copies, carbon copies of themselves by the thousands, and they then shoot out to colonize the next series of solar systems. So on our moon, there could be such a station by which you simply laser port yourself at the speed of light and simply materialize in the form of an avatar walking on the surface of the moon or whatever planet you feel like at that particular time. So my point of view is we have to think beyond little green men and flying saucers. We have to think beyond that. We have to think of if they're that advanced, they have technologies whereby they can digitize consciousness, where they can roam across the universe and rent different robotic bodies or holographic bodies and have great vacations exploring the galaxy. We have to really expand our imagination consistent with all the known laws of physics.
But wouldn't we then have to be able to precisely pinpoint where consciousness exists? Do we really know that it's in the mind? And how do we harness what we call true consciousness as opposed to perceptions and whatever the brain is working as, like a hard drive and processing?
Well, in my previous book, The Future of the Mind, I have a whole chapter on the question of consciousness. The first question people ask is, are animals conscious? Do they have a soul? Are they conscious? And my attitude is that, well, evolution is continuous. There's probably a continuous spectrum of different kinds of consciousness. And I think that, yeah, animals are probably conscious. And I think that, for example, alligators have spatial consciousness. They understand their location in space. They know where the prey is. They know where food is located. They have very good spatial consciousness. Then we have mouse-like consciousness. Mice are social animals. They have emotions. They have a social hierarchy. And so their consciousness is social consciousness, the consciousness of social hierarchy. And then what are we? What are humans? What separates us from animals like alligators that have very good spatial consciousness, probably better than ours, or wolves and mice that have social consciousness? What separates us from the animals? What separates us is time. We have temporal consciousness. We constantly simulate the future. Let's do an experiment. Go home tonight and teach your dog the meaning of tomorrow. You'll find very quickly you can't do it. Animals do not have a concept of tomorrow or next week or next year. They live in the present. That's what separates us. We are prediction machines. We can't help it. We're constantly daydreaming about the future. In fact, that's why we have a memory. It turns out that animals have very poor memories. They don't remember much, hardly at all. They live in the present. Why? Because they don't need to know the future. If you want to know the future, you have to know the past. When you brain scan the brain and ask the brain to daydream about the future, what part of the brain lights up? It's memory. Memory is trying to simulate the future. And that's what we humans do best, mainly in the prefrontal cortex, the front part of our brain. We are prediction machines. We like to predict things. Now take a look at robots. How advanced are robots? Are they as smart as an alligator, as smart as a mouse, or as smart as us? And you begin to realize, oh my God, robots are as smart as a cockroach. They barely understand their position in space. They barely understand where food is located, where their friends are located. They're just at the beginning of this scale. Now, of course, it'll take time. But we can foresee a time maybe by the end of the century when robots gradually become as smart as a mouse, then as smart as a rabbit, then as smart as a cat, then a dog, and finally by the end of the century, maybe they're as smart as a monkey. Then the question is, at what point do they become dangerous? I think they become dangerous mainly when they become as smart as a monkey, because monkeys are self-aware. They know they are not human. They know there's a distinction between humans and them. Most robots don't. Robots are clueless about their level of consciousness. So if you think of a scale of animals, you very rapidly understand where humans fit into this larger scheme of things.
You mentioned something that I found fascinating, too. You said, what is the difference between us and animals? And it's that ability to think forward. But children are very in the now, right? A lot of children are not fantasizing or thinking about the future or what comes next, but they are learning from the past. Has there ever been a study done on like a dog's brain or a child's brain on where that leap takes place? When does that quantum switch flip that we start focusing on tomorrow? And is there a way to stimulate that part of an animal's brain to bring them to a new level of consciousness?
Well, it starts at age two. If there's many families of scientists that have adopted children and animals and raised them together simultaneously at the same age in the same household. And they find that animals and monkeys and babies have roughly the same cognitive physical skills until they hit about the age of two. At that point, the monkey brain stops. Their prefrontal cortex doesn't grow much anymore. You see, the back of your brain is the oldest part of the brain. That's the reptilian brain, the brain of reptiles. Balance, territoriality, anger, that's the back of the brain. The center of the brain is the monkey brain, the brain of manners, social hierarchy, being nice to your elders. That's the center part of your brain. So evolution gives us back to the front. Now, the front part of the brain is the last part of the brain to evolve. It is the prefrontal cortex. It is the rational brain. It is the prediction machine at the front of the brain. Now, babies also evolve the same way. If you brain scan babies' brains, it develops from the back, where they develop balance, to the middle, where they begin to understand emotions and social hierarchy, and finally to the front part of the brain, the prefrontal cortex. So the differentiation starts at age two, but it's not finished till you're teenagers. In fact, if you brain scan the prefrontal cortex of a teenager, you're shocked. Shocked to find that it's not fully formed. That's why teenagers take enormous risks. That's why they don't understand the future, because they can't think things through, because their prefrontal cortex is still not fully developed. But we are prediction machines. By the time you're an adult, you can predict the future. Now, what's the difference between an adult and a child? What's the difference? The difference is adults understand the future. Children don't. That's what we call maturity. That's what we call being an upstanding member of society. Now, you can measure this. This is called the marshmallow test. It's a very famous test, one of the most famous tests in all of psychology. You give children two marshmallows. One marshmallow they can eat now, but the second marshmallow they can eat later, a few hours later, if they do something or other, okay? And then you ask yourself, which kid eats the first marshmallow and eats actually both marshmallows really quick? And then you follow these people over 30 years. You find that the people, the kids, who took all the marshmallows immediately wind up marginal in society. They take shortcuts. They're not socially mature. They're not leaders of society. Many of them are petty criminals. The people who held out, who understood the future, the payoff in the future, they have lower divorce rates, they have better health, they live longer, and they have higher income. So you see that this transition takes place starting at age two, but doesn't fully stop till after you're a teenager. But it really does determine how far you go in society. Successful people usually do very successfully on the marshmallow test.
Can that pathway, that neural pathway that your brain took, can it be reprogrammed even as an adult, though, to change those ways? So if you were somebody that would eat both marshmallows immediately, can you train it to see the difference now and kind of reimagine the brain waves? Or is that just something that is now hardwired into who we are?
Can have a significant change once they fall in love and find a partner and get married. It turns out that a lot of petty criminals realize that if they're going to keep a mate, if they're going to keep a woman, they're going to have to grow up. Women are not going to tolerate this nonsense. You know, they want to have kids. They want to have a life. They want to have a home and spending money and so on and so forth. And that requires you to settle down. So that's the point at which petty criminals will begin to settle down, is when they begin to realize they have to foresee the future. And that's what we humans do. That's what separates us from animals. That what separates us from robots. And when we talk about alien life that are super intelligent, what does that mean, super intelligent, if you have aliens that are super intelligent? To me, it means that they can simulate the future much better than us. That if you ask them to, you know, what's the best way to take over a planet, they have much better ways of doing it than us, who would be basically clueless talking about these cosmic questions. And so they would be able to outsmart us, be one step ahead of us, because they see the future better than us. And so that's what I think we mean when we talk about perhaps if we meet an alien intelligence and they're smarter than us, what does that mean? It means they can see the future better than us.
We have to take a break. Dr. Michio Kaku, our guest, the future of humanity, terraforming Mars, interstellar travel, immortality, and our destiny beyond Earth. You can find that book by visiting darknessradio.com and click on our killer deals link. It'll take you right into our Amazon page where we've collected all of the books you hear from the fantastic authors, making it available for you right now. So go check it out at darknessradio.com. Click on that killer deals link. We'll be back with more right after this.
Beyond the darkness.
You're back. This is Beyond the Darkness, your home for the best in paranormal talk radio 5 days a week, Monday through Friday. I'm your host, Dave, and along with me, my producer and co-host, Tim Dennis, and our guest today, Dr. Michio Kaku, the future of humanity, terraforming Mars, interstellar travel, immortality, and our destiny beyond Earth. And if you'd like to hear science, fantastic, and exploration, Dr. Kaku's radio show, then check out knsiradio.com. That's knsiradio.com, or you can get the KNSI Radio app and download it so you can stream the show and listen to it from that site as well. And that's the station that you can always find when I host Coast to Coast AM. That's a good way to get associated with that so you can listen to the show from anywhere and make it accessible to you. All right, Dr. Kaku, as we're talking about the idea of consciousness and where we can be and maybe loading what we were, our memories, our thoughts, and our ideas into these stacks so that someday people can access them in a library form and communicate, is that nothing more than a form of AI that's predicting what we would have said or how we would have responded to these questions and conversation from whoever comes to visit us? Or is this going to truly be the essence of who we are and what we were?
Well, many people, first of all, worry about AI because it's only a matter of time, they say, before they become smarter than us. I think that'll happen late in the century, not anytime soon, so don't worry about it. But then the question is, well, what do we do about it? What do we do if they become super intelligent in the next century? Sooner or later, they're going to become way smarter than us. At that point, I think we should seriously think about merging with them. That is, enhancing ourselves. This is not anytime soon. No one is talking about doing this anytime soon. But in the next century, this may be a possibility. And if we ever meet intelligent life in the universe and they land on the White House lawn, we may be rather surprised to find out that they're not totally biological, that they could be part cybernetic and part biological. And then the next question is, well, what are they going to look like? Are they going to look like some brain floating in a vat of liquid or some awful thing like that? And I think, no. I believe in something that I call the caveman factor, cave or cavewoman factor, and that is that our emotions have not changed for 100,000 years since we emerged from Africa. We still like to look good. We like to be attractive to the opposite sex. We like to have our the respect of our peers. And we don't want to have electrodes coming out of our head. We don't want to be stored in a vat of liquid. No, we want to look good. And so I think that far in the future, when we do begin to merge with these devices that will enhance our memory, enhance our intelligence, we'll still look like you and me because of the caveman factor. That we're not going to remodel our image because we want to be accepted by society, and that's hardwired. That's hardwired in our genes. And so I think that we will probably enhance ourselves. Already, for example, we can upload memories. Just 2 years ago, I wrote about it in my book, at Wake Forest University, they've been able to upload simple memories and record simple memories in mice. Now they're doing it on primates, like, you know, chimps, and eventually it'll be used for Alzheimer's patients. So when the memory fades for Alzheimer's patients, so they wander the streets, so they don't know who they are or where they live, they'll be able to push a button, a brain pacemaker, and remember. So the military has already given us a $70 million grant to build a memory chip for GIs from Afghanistan and Iraq. And so already we're in the process of being able to enhance our memory with a memory chip and with a brain pacemaker. Far in the future now, 100 years from now, when computers become very intelligent and rival us, we may want to take advantage of this and partially merge with them.
Do you believe
that? But we'll still look like us. We're not going to look like some freak, in other words.
Okay, so with Alzheimer's patients or patients that are dealing with dementia, if we're able to reignite or re-upload these memories, which would help to reconnect those broken factors, could we take what we know about Albert Einstein and the work that he did, and could we transplant false memories into people so that we could basically give life to Einstein again in the physical form of an Alzheimer's patient, give them what they believe to be their own memories, but it would be somebody else's personality, beliefs, and understandings and memories uploaded into them?
Well, I think that in the future, the library will not just be a book about Winston Churchill. You'll talk to him. There'll be a holographic image that has all his memories, all his quirks, his personality, and his history, and you'll talk to Winston Churchill. I mean, I wouldn't mind talking to Einstein. I'd love it if some Silicon Valley engineer could digitize him, so all his mannerisms and all his motions and his thinking process and his quotations are all computerized so that I could have a conversation with him. And like I mentioned, I think our descendants may have this possibility. So we're going to digitize ourselves and become immortal. This is called digital immortality. And I think digital immortality is a real possibility, that you'll be able to talk to your great-great-great-great-great-great-grandkids, and they'll be able to talk to you, because we've all been digitized and we'll be immortal in that sense. And like I mentioned, then we'll explore the galaxy. We'll shoot our consciousness to the stars and explore the galaxy this way. So this is a real possibility. It's well within the laws of physics. And I think that aliens probably have already done it.
Do you believe that parallel universes, multiverse, whatever it may be, are they a shade away from where we are right now? Is that what could be explaining paranormal, what we call ghost activity, the voices we hear, the somebody walking down the hall? It's nothing more than a glimmer from just a alternate reality, an alternate universe that's right up bumped against ours?
Well, believe it or not, we physicists believe that our universe could coexist with other parallel universes such that Elvis Presley is still alive. Now, this kind of freaks out people, but according to the laws of physics, quantum physics, people who are dead in one universe could conceivably be alive in another universe. Even today, we have conferences debating Schrodinger's cat. Can a cat be alive in one universe and yet dead in another universe? Now, how do we resolve this? Well, think of yourself sitting in a living room with a radio. The radio was on, but it tunes to one frequency. In principle, well, how many frequencies are there in that room? Thousands of frequencies. Radio Havana, Radio Moscow, whatever. A lot of frequencies in that room, but your radio is tuned to one. So vibrations are in phase with one frequency. The vibrations of the radio are not in phase with Radio Moscow or Radio Havana. That's why you don't hear them. Now we have Schrodinger waves, quantum waves. Everything is waving according to the quantum theory. And so in principle, in your living room is the waves of dinosaurs, because that comet or meteor missed the Earth 65 million years ago. So think about it. Right in your living room, not in outer space, not on the moon, right in your living room, there could be the waves of dinosaurs, pirates, aliens from outer space, or nothing, right in your living room. Now, why can't we then talk to Elvis Presley? If Elvis Presley is in your room, in principle, why can't we talk to him? Why can't we go from one to the other? For the same reason that your radio is tuned to Radio Moscow Havana or WABC, because you're in phase. You vibrate in phase with that universe. If you want to talk to Elvis Presley, you have to be in phase with him. But, of course, you're not. Your universe is not vibrating at the same frequency, not vibrating in the same way so that you can meet people from another universe. So, in other words, it is true that in your living room, there's the wave function of dinosaurs. But you can't talk to them. You can't interact with them because you have decohered from them. You're no longer in unison with them. And we physicists can actually calculate the degree to which you are out of phase with them. Therefore, the probability that you could somehow meet them, well, it's not zero, but you would probably have to wait longer than the lifetime of the universe in order to meet Elvis Presley.
All right. So theoretically, then, if I'm here and I'm having a memory, which everybody's talking about the Mandela effect, it's something that really is captured the imagination of a lot of the world here, and the idea that we're having these false memories on a grand scale. Could it be that there's a multiple universe version of Dave Schrader in each one of these existing universes, but the memory I'm having because of who I am, I'm somewhat, although not perfectly tuned in, I'm still threaded through each one of these different iterations of myself. So I might have memories of what they've experienced or they know. And if they're 3 seconds ahead or a week ahead or a year ahead of where I am, that's what's giving me these motions of deja vu, because I have briefly had that experience already occur in a different universe.
Well, let me say two things, because first of all, there's always an explanation that disputes this, but there's also an explanation that says, well, maybe it's possible. Deja vu, for example, if you brain scan people, you begin to realize that memory is very ephemeral, that you reform memories by getting pieces of memory scattered throughout your brain, reassembling them, reliving the memory, and then they scatter back to where they were originally. So memories literally have to be created and then disbanded, created and disbanded. And in the process, the memory gets diluted. It gets a little bit distorted as a consequence. So one theory is that because memory connects different parts of the brain into one whole, that perhaps you're accessing memories of things that look like the room that you visited years ago, and that gives you this sensation of deja vu. So in an MRI scan, you can begin to see the outlines of this. Well, that's one theory. Another theory is that, well, there are parallel realities out there. But like I said, we physicists can calculate the probability that you can move between parallel realities, and it's extremely small. Now, in the book, I also write about another possibility, and that is that in the future, our universe is going to die, and it's going to get very cold. We're going to hit the big freeze. All intelligent life in the universe will die when that happens. But that's going to happen trillions of years into the future, when intelligence will have trillions of years of technology. And at that point, they may decide to create a wormhole to move to another universe. And it would take a very big machine to do that. In my other books, I give you how big the machine would have to be. But according to the laws of quantum physics, it may be possible to build a machine that allows you to go to another universe, a universe which is warmer, a universe where we're not going to all freeze to death, okay? And who knows, maybe alien civilizations have mastered that technology. It can't be ruled out. The energy by which you can move between universes is called the Planck energy. It is 10 to the 19 billion electron volts. It is many times greater than anything we can summon on our planet Earth. But again, if civilizations in outer space are thousands of years ahead of us, then the Planck energy may not be such a daunting feat for them. They'd be able to play with space and time, which we cannot, but maybe they can. So what I'm trying to say is for us, many of the quantum things that you read about, like time travel and wormholes, they're not for us because we're too primitive. But for an advanced civilization, you can't rule it out.
All right. I know, like I said, I know many of our listeners are fascinated with the way science perceives, and I talked about it at the beginning of the show. You said we'd circle back into it. But when we talk about the science of spirituality and who we are outside of our physical form, I know you've talked about the possibilities for the future and a download image or memory of what we once are. But do you believe that our soul, not in an electronic or magnetic frequency recorded, but do you believe our soul does exist beyond, or our essence lives beyond our human form? And is there a quantifiable way to measure that?
Well, it gets back to what you just said. Can we measure it? In other words, first of all, in order to explain something, you have to define it. That's the first thing you got to do, mm-hmm. define it. Second, once you define it, then you can start to ask questions like, can you measure it? Now, if you think about the soul, there are, of course, thousands and thousands of books that have referenced the soul. But if you ask for a definition of it, you begin to find no one consensus as to what it is. And therefore, trying to measure it becomes even more difficult because there's no consensus on it. Now, some people have said that maybe the soul disappears when you die and therefore you weigh less. Well, that's actually a very good contribution because it means that you can weigh the body to see whether the body weighs less when you die. Well, that experiment has been done, and we find no difference. So, in other words, maybe it exists, maybe it doesn't. All I'm saying is that as we understand the brain, we realize that the brain can be digitized, and everything about the brain can be digitized. If the soul is in the brain, then yes, it can be digitized. Now, is the soul outside the brain? Well, that's called dualism, and we don't know because it's not a definable, measurable quantity. So once we find a measurement that is testable, reproducible, and falsifiable, then I can answer your question. Until then, the soul means anything to anybody because it's a slippery slope and everyone has their own personal definition of soul. For example, can the existence of God be proven? I was on a discussion once in Mexico where we had two sides. One side, there were Catholic theologians who said, yes, the existence of God can be proven. On the other side were atheists like Richard Dawkins, who said, no, God cannot be measured. And what was my position? My position was very simple. It's not a scientific question. It's not decidable. There's no one experiment that can determine the existence of God. Until then, it's a definitional question. So I said, 1,000 years from now, 1,000 years from now, we could have the same debate about proving the existence of God, because it's not a testable, reproducible, falsifiable statement. So once someone gives me a definition of soul, then we can begin the process of measuring it or measuring the lack of it. In the meantime, if the soul is in the brain, we can digitize the brain. And if the soul is in the brain, then it too will be digitized.
Well, there are some levels of science that have started to look at near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences, and they have been able to see that people that make these claims that have gone out of body will witness things that they have no way to know. The conversation that took place in the room or the room next to it, the signs that are put up in the ceiling tiles, things that are outside of the realm of human consciousness and the fact of awareness of our surroundings, but something that seems elevated and above that. If science is starting to look at that and coming back with some data that says, well, you know, this is interesting because they are having these experiences, why is it then we can't track? I mean, you can look at things in a subatomic way at this point. We're able to break it down to that level. Why can't we find the pathway or the energy that seems to transcend in these moments of near-death experiences or out-of-body, you know, experiences?
Well, there are two ways of looking at it, and you cannot rule out either one.
Mm-hmm.
One way to look at it is that, well, maybe they did die and had a near-death experience in heaven. You know, it can't be ruled out. However, there is another way of looking at it. If you take a look at epileptics, where parts of the brain have to be removed in order to do experiments and accelerate the healing process in epileptics, and you have electrodes stimulating parts of the brain, and you stimulate two lobes simultaneously, two lobes, one, for example, with hearing and one with eyesight, the brain gets confused. because all of a sudden two things are being stimulated simultaneously. And at that point, the brain starts to have out-of-body experiences. Now, you can talk to these people as this experiment is being done. The brain does not feel pain. Therefore, you can remove half the skull and talk to these people, have a very nice conversation with them, because they don't feel anything at all. But when you do this experiment and you touch two lobes simultaneously, they immediately say, I'm floating. I'm floating in air. I can see my body. I'm floating in the air. I'm looking down on my body. And then when you remove the probes, it disappears. In fact, you can do this like a light switch. Like a light switch, you can stimulate the brain simultaneously, and they feel out-of-body experiences, and remove it, and it disappears. It's almost like a light switch. Now, does that explain all out-of-body experiences? No. This is just out-of-body experiences in epileptics under very controlled situations in a hospital when we stimulate the exposed brain. What happens in an accident when someone has a near-death experience? I don't know. All I'm saying is, it's possible. Maybe they did go to heaven. You can't rule it out. But again, is it testable? Is it falsifiable? And is it measurable? For me, as a scientist, that's the question that we ask.
People that will encounter what they believe to be hauntings or visitations from spirits, they'll ask me for definitive answers, which I'll tell them too. There is no definitive answer to any of this. Is it our memory being triggered? Is it the way of our grief system being handled? But then you go into a place where you don't know the history, and suddenly you're confronted with a vision of somebody that lived there. Later on, you see a picture and it matches up with the person that you saw in that moment, or the voices that are heard out loud. Do you believe that this is something that's unique to the individual, or do you believe that this is something that's unique to the location? And as you said earlier, kind of the frequency of that location and how it resonates.
Well, again, you cannot rule out the fact that maybe there are ghosts. We have to be open to it. Again, ghosts are not measurable or testable, but maybe they can exist. We have to entertain that possibility. However, there's also another interpretation as well. And that is, the normal state of the human brain is to hallucinate. Now, we think of hallucination as for crazy people and for weirdos and people who are insane. No, the natural state of the human brain is to hallucinate. For example, we can even do experiments that have been done repeatedly. You can put a man in a darkened room with scary music in the background and have him bump into things because the lights are dim. And all of a sudden, he sees an animal walking really fast, okay? Or all of a sudden, he hears a sudden noise. He'll hallucinate. He'll complete the dots. He'll say, oh, it was a tiger. Oh, it was a lion. It was this. It was 5 feet tall. It was so on and so forth. No, it was fake. But you can induce the hallucination under controlled conditions, under measurable, testable, controlled conditions. You can induce hallucinations on a normal person. Now, when you take a look at someone who's schizophrenic, okay, they hear voices. And if you brain scan someone who is hallucinating by hearing voices, you see that the left part of the brain is active. The left part of the brain is the brain of audio signals, and it's the brain that talks to you. Right now, your left brain is lighting up because you're listening to my voice and you're trying to make sense of it. So the left part of your brain is lighting up. The front part of your brain is the thinking brain. For schizophrenics, when they have an episode, the left brain lights up, but the front brain is unaware of it, not aware of it. In other words, you're literally talking to yourself without your permission. Now, that's called madness. Why are people mad? They're mad because they hear voices from God, heaven, wherever. They hear voices that tell them to do things. But it's really the brain talking to itself. And so the point I'm raising is, believe it or not, hallucinations, audio and visual hallucinations, are actually good for us, and we're good for our evolution, because we had to complete the dots. In the forest, when the leaves rustled, we had to complete the dots and assume that it was not the wind, it was a tiger. Because 9 times out of 10, it was not a tiger, but that 1 time out of 10, it saved your butt. And so we have to entertain the possibility that hallucinations are normal for the human race.
And now we know that things like nicotine and caffeine and dehydration and lack of sleep can all inspire these hallucinations as well, right? So there's a lot at play in what people have and what they believe to be a perceived real experience.
That's right. And also when you dream, we've now brain scanned people when they dream, and it's very interesting. The center part of the brain is active. The amygdala is there. That governs nightmares and fear. That lights up brilliantly when you are asleep. But the front part of your brain is shut down. The front part of your brain gets very little blood, and the front part of your brain is a fact checker. It has the laws of reason and common sense. It's shut down. And so the reason why you dream is because the center part of the brain is quite active, and it lights up, and therefore you start to imagine things when you dream. So that is the normal state of affairs, that the brain deals with things that are imaginary, which is good for it, because it helped our evolution, because it helped us to complete the dots, even though many times the dots were done incorrectly. The few times that the dots were done correctly, it saved our butt. And so that's why our ancestors survived. While our ancestors who didn't have this ability to hallucinate, they're gone.
When people believe that they can lucid dream and control their dreams, are they really engaging both parts of the brain then, the front part that does the thinking, the rationality, and the dream part of the brain?
Well, at the Max Planck Institute in Germany, they've actually brain scanned lucid dreamers. And they found that it's true. You can actually control the direction of your dream. It turns out that when you dream, you are paralyzed. Otherwise, you'd act out your dream.
Right.
And so you know exactly when you are dreaming, when you undergo paralysis and rapid eye movement. And lucid dreamers, it turns out that the center part of their brain, the amygdala, lights up in an MRI scan, as it should. But the front part of the brain is perfectly conscious during the whole process. That's different from the normal brain. And you can train yourself to do this, by the way. There are Buddhist texts which train you to become lucid dreamers, and we now know it's true. Brain scans have conclusively shown that these people have the prefrontal cortex lit up, they're conscious, but the center part of their brain, which dreams, lights up like a Christmas tree. They're fully conscious in the process, and there are lessons that you can use to become a lucid dreamer. For example, have a notebook. Write down your dreams as soon as you have them, because within minutes, you begin to forget your dreams. Have a habit of writing down all your dreams. Before you dream, mentally prepare yourself. Say that you're going to lucid dream tonight. Prepare yourself to say, when I dream tonight, I'm going to be conscious. These are lessons that lucid dreamers use, and it works. They control the direction of their dream, and now we can prove it.
Well, then, couldn't we measure, isn't it mediumship, psychics and mediumship, isn't that a measurable point that if we're looking at the brain that deals with fantasy and imagination, is the frontal part of the brain that deals with the reality also engaged during that point so that we can see that there is something more going on than just imagination or creativity filling the void?
Say it again. I didn't quite get it. Say it again.
People that claim to have people that have mediumistic ability or claim that they can speak to the dead or see ghosts, if they're dealing with this as well, wouldn't it be the two sections of the brain that should light up simultaneously? Again, it's not just the fantasy and creative aspect of it, but it would be the part of the brain that does the rational thinking?
Well, that I cannot say. Everything I've talked about so far is rooted in scientific facts that
right.
are testable, falsifiable, reproducible. However, when you talk about dealing with mystics and psychics, unfortunately, very few psychics and mystics have been subjected to MRI scans. Now, that doesn't mean they can't be done. That doesn't mean they haven't done it. It's just that I'm unaware of studies that have been done, so I can't answer the question at this point. Now, unfortunately, I have to leave. Unfortunately, I have another phone call because I'm on a schedule and I'm on a book tour. So I'm really sorry to say that I have to go now.
Well, I appreciate your time, and we do on the show. Thank you so much for joining us. And again, the book,
and
The Future of Humanity.
It's been a real pleasure to be on the show.
It's great. We'll hopefully chat again, and it won't take 13 years next time, I hope. Michio Kaku, The Future of Humanity, Terraforming Mars, Interstellar Travel, Immortality, and Our Destination Beyond Earth. You can find a link to that at Darkness Radio under the Killer Deals link. That's it for today. We'll be back again tomorrow with more of the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.
want your child to thrive and reach their full potential. K-12 can help them get there. K-12-powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.